Hello and welcome to Countrywide. This morning, fears of a wipeout of fish on the iconic River Blackwater in Cork. Preparations on a farm in Fuddlestown in Wexford for a local music festival. And tomorrow in Clare, a celebration of Irish native rare breed animals. Well, you're very welcome this morning. And we are going to start with Harvest 2025 on Irish farms all around the country. If you've been travelling, you might have seen combine harvesters and tractors on the roads and in the fields cutting the crops and bringing them in. And some farmers are also posting on social about how their harvest is going. Overall, Harvest 2025 is shaping up to be a reasonably positive one. The weather has stayed dry, the yields have been pretty good. It's been an exceptionally early harvest with many farmers finished their work already. But as always, it is a less rosy picture when it comes to prices. Well, we'll be talking more about this shortly. But first, let's hear from Owen McLaughlin, a 23-year-old farmer from Trim in Meath, who sowed a crop of beans for the first time. Well, during the week, it was time to harvest them, and I was there.
Well, the crop, it nearly looks kind of barren, except for the beans itself. They resemble like tumbleweed you'd see in the western, so it's just that kind of crunchy and
it's like there's been a fire. And if you open one there, they're charcoal, they're very, very dry.
Yeah. It's like a kind of a leathery type of jacket, and then it just falls away and it just reveals a pale, kind of creamy bean inside. There's four in this pot. Some of them go up to maybe six. But they're small enough in size. They're essentially just a tall stalk with all the leaves gone off it, and it's brown, nearly black in colour.
So the stalks look like that. I mean, they're very, very dry and burnt looking. And then the pods, if anyone knows green beans, it's kind of similar, except these are charcoal black. And they are, you can hear this now. And then inside are these cream coloured beans.
Yeah, it doesn't take much trashing at all. They're a little bit small in size, but no, they're perfect. You can even...
Can you try one? Well, they're really hard.
Yeah.
I'm going to break a tooth now. I phoned you yesterday to ask you, could I come out today to record the harvest? And you said to me, I'll tell you what, Ella, I'm going to go out to the field first to check if it's ready, and I'll get back to you. When you went out yesterday, what were you looking for? How do you know when this is ready?
Well, moisture, yeah, there's a little moisture meter in the cabot combine, and you just take a sample and crush it, and it is able to read the highest point of moisture and then the lowest point, and you can tell then what moisture it is generally. At there yesterday, it was 18%, so I presume it's a little bit lower now because it has dried up. The lower the moisture, the better it stores in the shed. At the moment, I'm not particularly that fussy, as it's all, no matter what, it's getting crimped and treated safer that way. That there's no hassle with selling it.
When did you start to grow beans like this?
This is the first year, so it was a bit of an experiment. I wanted to put a winter crop. This land is away from home, so it's just as easy to sow all at one time. You get the protein payment. It adds nitrogen to the ground, as it's a legume. And it was the better alternative to peas for that reason. And it also has a better ability to stand and for harvest. This ground, it would be in tillage a long time, so I think it's due a bit of muck this year, so it wouldn't be particularly rich, and it seemed to be done just
You're
fine.
Happy enough. Yeah, that's fantastic. Your first year doing it, where are they going to end up?
These beans will be sold for cattle feed. I sell it alongside barley I've already harvested this year.
Yeah. And farmers would buy this as an alternative to buying, say, soya from South America?
Exactly, or the mixed rations from all the big co-ops. I'd be selling it in bulk instead of little bags. Do you know what kind of...
Yeah, and are more and more farmers looking to Irish-grown protein sources for their cattle, or is it just a matter of whichever is cheapest?
I would imagine it's whatever is cheapest and most convenient to the farmer, but being able to source your produce locally naturally seems more convenient to me.
Yeah, and you're not cutting down Amazon rainforests. Yeah. And there's all those issues as well, aren't there, from soya from South America. Are you in conversion or are you organic?
I'm in second year conversion, and so next year I'll be getting my organics, full organic symbol. So I won't be putting in a winter crop this year, I'll be putting it in springtime, because you have to wait for the land to turn into the third year so that it can be claimed organic.
Why have you decided to go organic?
being organic, you get an extra payment, so there's you're covering your costs even before harvest a little bit more. There's less inputs. Go to your organic tillage system, is quite simple. You just plant the crop and come back and harvest it.
Given it's your first year at this, how has the harvest gone this season then? You've never harvested these beans before.
No, I'm satisfied. To be honest, I hadn't much hope for them because there was people telling me that they were going to be consumed by chocolate spot. But no.
What's that?
It's a disease they get that creates a little black spot on their leaves and then causes the leaves to fall. It gets into the bean itself and just causes the rot. But luckily enough, it hadn't happened.
So then the question of prices. Are you forward selling? Is this already sold or are you now looking for markets?
I'm looking for markets. So I'll probably advertise once it's all safe in the shed and processed, be putting up on the organic trading hub or Dundeal, looking to sell a few lorry loads of beans. Then.
Yeah.
This is quite unusual for beans to be ripe this early. I know that last year there was, because I sowed it quite early, I sowed it in the end of October, but normally you sow beans in January, and there was lads last year harvesting them in November, so which is a bit late to go harvesting, in my opinion. You'd like to get it done by then.
How long is it going to take you to finish this up?
I'll be hoping between today and tomorrow.
And you'll be done.
Yeah. I do like harvesting. When it's going well, there's nothing better, but then once in a lodge crop and there's breakdowns, there's nothing worse.
We're standing in front of your combine. Just describe how it works.
If you could think about scissors on the front of the combine, and there's about maybe 100 of them, so it just cuts the stem of the crop. Well, it's gently flicked in by the reel, which is it rotates above the crop,
yep,
and into the auger, and then it's
walk back down the side of it.
It's brought along in through the feeder house,
which is underneath where you sit.
Yeah, and there's then a drum, and that drum catches the crop and rubs it against the grid. Some of the grain then goes through that grid and onto a sieves. The straw, which is what the grain is on, gets thrown up onto a moving floor. They're called walkers, and it gets tossed and shaked, and then the grain falls through the walkers and back onto the sieve, and then there's air that is blown from underneath the sieve, getting rid of all the chaff. The grain goes through the sieve and up into the tank.
So you're separating the beans from the chaff here.
Exactly, yeah.
And the beans are left over, and now you need, there's a tractor over here with a big trailer, you need to
unload
everything that you've already harvested into that trailer.
Yeah, and then it'll be drawn back home.
There's a big arm coming out the side of the combine, and out of that arm are all the beans. Sounds like rain, but there's just thousands and thousands of beans pouring into the trailer. Well, there you go. That's how farmer Owen McLaughlin's harvest has gone this summer. So how about the rest of the country? Well, here are a few voices from the field. We have Joe Warren in Wexford, Peter Lynch in Donegal, and first, John Lawler, who farms with his father, Pat, in Westmeath. They produce Kilbeggan oats for human consumption.
We had an excellent harvest this year. The yields were really high compared to the last 2 years. And the bushel was slightly lower than the last 2 years. The bushel tells you about how well the grain is filled. So it's down slightly, but you'd expect that in a year where you have a bumper tonnage per acre. So we're fortunate enough not to have to depend on the mills and the merchants for a price, as I'm sure a lot of farmers in the country are waiting anxiously to hear what sort of prices they're going to be getting at the merchants.
My name is Peter Lynch. I farm near Newton Cunningham in County Donegal. We grow winter and spring malt barley, winter barley for feed, winter wheat for feed, and winter oilseed rape for Donegal rapeseed oil. The winter malt done 2.8 tonnes the acre, and the spring malt done 1.8. Both yields were back. Spring was a disaster, mostly down to aphids infecting in the springtime, and that's solely down to not having the chemicals to be able to control the aphids anymore. Both the malt passed, so there's probably a premium of 40 to 50 a tonne over feed for that. Hopefully harvesting winter wheat now this weekend, and it looks to have good potential. Winter barley averaged 3.7 tonnes the acre. which we're happy enough with, but the prices on the floor, they're talking about 175 a tonne at 20% moisture, maybe 180, but that's nowhere near where we'd need to be. In the lighter world markets, we're going to need some sort of government support. Our biggest challenges this past year have been rabbits, believe it or not, and winter barley and winter oilseed rape.
My name is Joe Warren, near Ballycarney, County Wexford. At the moment, we have finished cutting all the winter barley and malting barley. The weather has been fantastic for harvesting. However, yields have been impacted by the drought on the light soils. Extreme temperatures in early July caused this. Bushel weights have dropped. Rejection rates for malting barley have now increased. The current harvesting price being offered this year, they're below the cost of production, which makes the future of tillage uncertain if prices don't improve.
Well, thanks to Joe, Peter and John there. And I'm delighted to say we're joined by Dr. Siobhan Walsh, tillage editor with the Farmers Journal, and Dr. David Hobson, a tillage farmer in Meath. Siobhan and David, good morning. Siobhan, I'm going to start with you. You've been travelling around Ireland to see how Harvest 2025 has gone. Is it fair to say it's a story of an early harvest? Yields are reasonably good. Farmers are overall happy, but prices now are a separate thing.
Yeah, morning, Ella. Thanks for having me on. Yeah, I think you've got it in one there. We've been travelling around the country on the Irish Farmers Journal's crop tour. And yeah, look, it's been a dream harvest as regards getting work done. And in fairness, the year gone by has been very good to get work done. We had a dry autumn, a dry spring, which is the opposite to what we've had for the last 2 years. It was very easy to get fertiliser sprays applied during the season. Everything was done at the right time. Unfortunately, though, that dry weather continued and crops that we thought had really good potential probably lost some of that potential. So while crops yielded well, they probably didn't reach the potential that they could have reached. But overall, look, farmers are happy to get crops in, saved in good condition and at reasonably good yields. And as you said, price is the big one now. And
price is the next thing. I mean, just to get into the weather, I mean, I know that so much, I mean, it's sort of 80% the weather, really. In the UK, some tillage farmers have seen exceptionally dry conditions. And I saw there that Jeremy Clarkson posted that this year's harvest is going to be catastrophic. Is it the same here or is it very regional in Ireland how the dryness has affected the land?
Look, the UK has been hit very severely compared to us. Their weather has been much drier and much hotter. So look, we're definitely not in that case. But I think, it's been varied here. Like, we've seen higher yields definitely down the south of the country where they seem to have got more rain at the right time. Like you heard Peter there, he got 1.8 on his spring barley. That's the low end of the spring barley, but it's not uncommon. Whereas there would be some farmers that are yielding over 3 tonne on spring barley. And look, 3 tonne would, I suppose, be the target on spring barley. In some years, and go back to 2022 when we had a really good year, there was farmers getting up to 4 tonne on their spring barley. So Peter is under half that. So definitely there are regions of the country that just after planting, they got heavy rain and then they got severe dry weather and those crops just didn't yield. There was one crop there. The dry weather came, more rain came, and a second crop grew. So you had secondary growth, and that grain is poor quality and didn't fail. It just won't weigh.
It won't weigh at all. David, one of the crops you sow is oilseed rape, and I gather it is shaping up to be one of the most successful harvests this summer in a very long time.
Yeah, so we grow oilseed rape here in County Meath, and we are experiencing probably a 30% increase in our yield compared to last year. And we've had probably the best average yield across our farm in many years. And it's probably due to the fact that we had quite a mild back end in the autumn. Crops got established early and they didn't have too much grazing from pigeons and disease. And I suppose the spring was kind to them. They had a lot of sunlight. May was probably like a record month for sunshine. And they had just the right amount of water. And so the grain fill period was really good. So
they had a good head
very
start.
Pleasing harvest.
And I know that you have an agreement with New Grange Gold. They buy all your crop for rapeseed oil to be sold for human consumption. And prices look like they'll return a good profit for the farmer. But what about prices for the likes of wheat, barley and oats?
Yeah, so look, that's we've been working with New Grange for about 8 years now. And that has definitely, you know, given us a bit more confidence in price, because we're both working together to sort of agree a sort of a price. But I suppose on the global end of things, you know, global markets are sort of on the floor, and this is mostly due to the oversupply of feed grains. So, you know, the US is experiencing potentially its biggest ever corn crop, 424 million tons of corn be produced there, and Brazil had their second biggest corn crop there harvested last spring. So all like that puts pressure on the overall market. We also see the EU, like the French harvest is up 30% compared to last year.
So we see that basically if a farmer has a really good yield, the problem is if everyone does, then you have a glut and then prices go down.
Exactly.
Yeah. Siobhan,
exactly.
Can I ask you, just to go to Siobhan there, so much of the cereals, the beans, the peas, the wheat and all the rest, they don't end up in human mouths. They're for livestock like cows. And it seems logical that Irish-grown grain would be used first to feed animals here. We have about 3 million tonnes of cereals and oilseeds that were imported into Ireland last year with about 2 million tonnes grown here. Should there be a greater emphasis on an Irish-first approach to feeding livestock instead of sourcing the feed globally?
Yeah, look, you'd like that to happen. We actually import about 6 million tonnes of animal feed into the country. So
even
we produce
more.
Just over 2 million, and maybe 1.5 of that or a little bit more is used in animal feed, because the others is used for malting or oats, whatever it is. But yes, I think we'll always need to import animal feed. We've so many animals in the country, we can't feed them all from our grain. But we need to use our Irish grain strategically. And, you know, we see the likes of Kerrygold butter, it's a premium product. And maybe we can make premium products using Irish grain. You know, instead of looking at just grass fed, maybe we can have, you know, Irish grass and Irish grain fed. And there is a demand for some of these niche products, but we need to target our Irish grain strategically, that it goes into these niche products and delivers the tillage farmer a niche product, that we're not just competing in the world market, on the commodity market, against all of these other imported grains. Because let's face it, David there on his farm is farming to stricter rules than other countries. We heard Joe Warren, I think it was, or Peter, it was Peter. He had, he said he couldn't control the aphids on his farm because the chemistry isn't there. We're competing against countries around the world that are using chemistry that's banned in the EU for many years, and against countries that are using GM grain. And, you know, farmers in Ireland are basically farming with one hand tied behind their back. So there should be a premium being paid for grain. That's you know, we're competing against people who have much more technology to fight disease and other things and get higher yields. So you'd like a premium to be paid for that higher quality and traceable grain.
Indeed. And David, just finally, we heard there from John Lawler, who runs a very successful Kilbeggan organic oats from his farm in Westmeath. They sell their own oats direct to the public. You do obviously something similar with oilseed rape. The Irish flour market for things like bread and baking has clear potential. I mean, is this something that the government needs to get behind a lot more?
Yeah, well, I suppose like in our neck of the woods here in the Northeast, like we don't have a whole lot of added value crops. Like in the South, most of the malt and barley originates from there, and we don't have there's a very small milling sector in Ireland currently, and it's mostly for artisan bakeries, and it's mostly organic as well. But we can produce, you know, milling wheat. We import, you know, 300,000 tons of milling wheat into the country, and there's definitely scope to add value there, I think, in the future, and also just to help support our prices and alternative markets to feed, we could do it at milling sector.
And Siobhan, I suppose the limiting factor there, as it always is processing capacity.
Yeah, and look, that milling wheat and oilseed rape processing are outlined in the Food Vision Tillage Report as areas to investigate. And we need more premium markets like that. You know, the malting barley market this year now is severely impacted. So we've basically lost a big chunk of our premium markets. So that Food Vision Report really needs to be worked on. And a big thing in that Food Vision Report, and one of the first actions in it, is to give farmers the support this year and into the next 5 years as well. Because, you know, you've heard all the farmers say price is the big problem this year. So really, tillage farmers this year, unfortunately, need support from government.
All right. Well, listen, thank you so much, Siobhan Walsh and Dave Hobson, for joining us this morning. And to all the farmers out there who continue their harvest over the next few weeks, best of luck in bringing the crops in. Well, if you're west of the Shannon tomorrow, the Irish Native Rare Breed Society is going to have a celebration of all their animals at Bunratty Castle in Clare, with breeds like Dexter and Irish Moyled Cattle, Kerry Bog Ponies, Galway Sheep and Old Irish Goats. And they are moving on then to Longford Westmeath Mart on the 24th of August for another event. It's all part of National Heritage Week, which starts tomorrow, with thousands of events. Many of them are free. Well, the Drimmin is one of Ireland's oldest cattle breeds, and Tom Keane, who farms with his brother Michael on the Shannon Estuary, has a herd, and he's also involved in tomorrow's event in Bunratty. Tom, good morning.
Good morning, Ellen.
You are making, it's kind of an interesting sideline, you've got a Drimmin hide that you've harvested and you're making a coracle traditional boat, I gather, tomorrow.
Yeah, the hide was supplied by Herbert Farrell, who's farming a herd of Drimmins on Quaker Island in Lough Ree. And it's been stretched over the frame tomorrow, so the finishing touches will be done for a live viewing. So it's a single cowhide frame, cowhide stretched over a single frame. So it's a very ancient type of boat.
It's going to start at 10. You're going to have lots of animals on show, but you're also going to have a discussion about why it matters to keep native rare breeds going on farms.
Yeah, I mean, they're linked with the past, but they're not just a relic. So that there is a future and there is a place for them, particularly in high nature value farming and with an increased focus on conservation grazing. And so what we're hoping to do tomorrow is to gather people from all walks, public and private, concerned with high nature value farming and a better ecological land management system, and where these livestock may fit into that system.
Great. And as I said, if you can't make it tomorrow, there's another event on Saturday, the 24th of August, at the Longford Westmeath Mart in Ballymahon, where you can have a second chance to see the rare breeds as well. Tom, best of luck tomorrow. I hope the weather stays good for you. And all the groups that are organising events for Heritage Week across the country, heritageweek.ie for those events. And for more on Irish native rare breeds, you can go to inrbs.ie. Well, we're back with Seaweed and Cork after these.
Email countrywide at rte.ie. Countrywide on RTE Radio 1.
51551 for your texts, and countrywide at rte.ie for emails. The economy of many coastal communities has really changed in the last few decades, from fishing towards other newer marine-based industries. Well, back in 1992, Michael O'Neill started out as a fisherman in Castle Danbair in Cork. By 2010, however, he and his wife had launched the Irish Atlantic Sea Salt brand from their home on the Beara Peninsula. And from there, Michael turned his focus to cultivating local seaweed for use in nutritional supplements. And more recently, he's teamed up with scientists from the University of Limerick to explore the potential of seaweed in managing type 2 diabetes. Well, Lorna Siggins went to West Cork, where the seaweed is being cultivated, grown in baths inside temperature-controlled buildings right beside the sea.
We're about 6 degrees, I think, in here at the moment.
Okay, yeah.
So
that's what they like.
Yeah, they like cold. And we bring them through various different phases. So we start off with our seeds. We settle onto nets. We put our nets to sea. We grow our nets for 6 months. We harvest the nets. We take the big plants and we would process them. And then the smaller plants, we feed back into the system for the next year.
So you're recreating currents,
that's right,
here.
When you keep the seaweed tumbling, it grows. It likes that environment.
So it likes to be tossed around.
Exactly.
I see. Yeah, that just
looks... See that beautiful deep
beautiful. Lovely dulse. So are they growing faster this way than if they were...
We can control the rate, and that's a lot of it. So we want to put healthy, strong plants to see. There's a lot more competition out there. Again, I think we're the only company in the world doing dulse at sea and on land. My family would have been originally, this would be my mother's family's farm. My father is from Erin, or was from Erin. I was born in the Channel Islands, a product of a previous recession, I suppose would be the best way of putting it.
I just followed Michael down a windy, narrow track over what felt like a cliff on the Barra Peninsula to the stunning location.
So now, compass points south. What are we looking at?
Mizzen Head, straight south from us. Sheep's Head, here to the east. Bear Island.
Bear Island and the beacon.
The beacon's the entrance to Castletown Bear Harbour. So we can see, if we were to go around the corner here, you'd be able to see Blackball Head, the Dursey Head and the Dursey. So on a fine day, it's great. Well, I think it's actually better on a rough day, to be quite truthful about. The power of the sea is, can be well appreciated from here.
And you fished that area?
Yep.
I would have fished. In the early 1990s?
That's right. We would have had two boats, lobster and crab fishing, and we were fishing from the harbour's mouth. So part of the year down around up to the Mizzen, and then for the rest of the year we were in Kenmare Bay at lobster.
What made you decide then to switch to aquaculture?
Men in small boats like to think that they'll have big boats, and we kind of looked at the opportunities to go bigger, and it got tighter. More pots, less crab, less lobster, and we cut back to one boat, and eventually we decided we'd move on, because I think the writing was on the wall even back in, you know, the late 90s that it was going to get tighter. We looked at aquaculture. All the good mussel sites were gone. We have a small farm here, about 50 hectares of 20 of that of rock. Rock makes good foundations, though.
Right, going from the cliffs up the hill.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
So we decided we might look at land-based production. I suppose that's where it started. We built a facility here in 2006. So it's probably the biggest nursery in Europe, as far as we're aware. But it's not so much about the size of the building. That's just, I suppose that gives us the capacity to scale. It's what we do inside, and it is quite special.
And you'd hardly notice it. It's completely camouflaged in below
absolutely.
The rock here.
Absolutely. You know, it's even from the sea, it's difficult to see. That was part of one of the many planning stipulations that we had. So that's our header tank. So we basically pump to a header tank, and then we gravity feed after that into the building.
So you're pumping seawater up?
Up from here, from in the field. Up.
Okay.
Into the reservoir, we gravity feed the system then inside, and yeah, like I say, I think depending on what we're growing, different type. We have recirculation systems, which we know a lot about how to keep seawater, you know, in optimum condition. It is about conditioning as much seawater rather than what's in it.
Is it a costly operation?
Everything is costly, but I think it's not as costly as we were told it would be. I'm an engineer, I'm not a biologist, so. We focused on more the mechanical side of things, and we were able to get and put in place some really effective and efficient processes that really negate some of those high costs that were, I suppose, identified initially. The way we're going, we have a processing facility on the other side of the hill, and we integrated solar energy there last year. Ultimately, we're looking to create an off-grid option.
Pure Ocean Algae qualified for Enterprise Ireland funding to research how dulse can help to manage type 2 diabetes, working with the University of Limerick.
It's been a long 4 years, but we seem to be making a lot more progress than anybody else out there. There's companies doing this, and there'll be companies doing it. We might be slightly ahead at the moment, but we live in the Barra Peninsula. We're not in the centre of things. So it's just nice occasionally to, you know, to be up there with the best of them, if not be slightly ahead.
Yeah.
And to be in such a location, you know, such a location, isolated location.
And I suppose, considering how tough commercial fishing is now, you would say, well, there are other opportunities that will give you a living on the coast.
Certainly, and I think we've generational experience in the fishing industry of working on the water. And I think when you look at the new opportunities that are out there, and be it floating wind, be it seaweed farming, I think they are there and they are transferable. And we're very, very lucky. And that's the difference. I think one of our strongest points compared to other companies when we look across Europe is our ability to understand how to work at sea. We just have the skills. It's something that other people have to learn. And you can have fantastic land-based capacity, but if you can't implement it at sea or don't understand the environment, it's a big piece missing. We have that.
So we have
living with
people.
The Atlantic.
Living with the Atlantic, exactly.
Michael O'Neill there of Pure Ocean Algae talking to Lorna Siggins. Amazing to see the potential of seaweed. It's got so many uses, replacing plastics used in pharma, food production, and as you heard from Michael as well, the potential to deal with diabetes as well. So thank you to Michael there. We're going to stay in Cork. You may remember a few months ago we reported on a major fish kill on the River Aloe, which is a tributary of the River Blackwater. Well, earlier this week, very sadly, reports emerged of a huge fish kill on the River Blackwater itself. It was initially believed to affect an 8-kilometre stretch between Mallow and Roskeen Bridge. However, the scale of the incident has grown massively, and locals now say that at least 30 kilometres of river have been affected, with thousands of fish killed. Well, the alarm was first raised by a local man who went walking with his dogs, and he spotted dead fish, and he contacted his nearest angling club, and the club in turn alerted the authorities. There is an official investigation underway to find out what has happened and why these fish have all died. But here's Conor Arnold. He's a well-known angling guide on the Blackwater, describing for us what he saw.
So on Thursday evening, between Lumbardstown, Mallow and Killavullen angling clubs, we recovered over 3,500 dead fish from the river. It started off with small fish, juvenile salmon, trout. Now there's adult trout, up to 2, 3, 4 pounds. There's adult salmon. And there's eels, there's dace, there's roach, there's stickleback. It's across the whole spectrum. It's soul destroying for all the angling clubs involved to see an ecological disaster of this scale. The latest now at the moment is we've been advised to stay out of the river, not to go in to recover any more fish until we have test results back to try and conclude what is causing this. But at the moment, we do not know.
Conor Arnold there. Well, joining me is Ken Whelan, a professor in the School of Biology and Environmental Science in UCD. Good morning, Ken.
Good morning, Ella.
Ken, you are not someone to mince your words, but you're also not someone to exaggerate. And you have decided to use a particular word to describe what has happened here. And that word is catastrophic.
Yeah, as you say, Ella, I'd be very loath to use that word normally. But seeing the images that all of us have now seen and listening to the reports from Connor and lots of my other friends down on the Blackwater, I'm just really, really amazed and horrified at what we're looking at. Just to give your listeners an idea, normally if you have a pollution, as you say, it'll be in a river like the Aloe. I remember years ago, another tributary, the Blackwater, called the Funchen, had a bad fish kill. But to have a fish kill of this scale in the main stem of one of Ireland's major rivers for what is now, as you say, thought to be 20 to 30 kilometres, and all fish species to be affected, including minor fish species like little sticklebacks, as well as everything right up to salmon. It's unprecedented to a large extent in terms of the scale and the actual extent of the problem.
It's obviously vital for the authorities to get to the heart of what exactly happened and what caused this. This will take a bit of time. But do you have a sense, Ken, of what might have been the cause?
I think it's probably too early even to speculate about that. But just to reassure the listeners that the teams that are out there from IFI and my former colleagues in the Marine Institute are some of the best fish pathologists in Europe. So we have a very good team that's actually working on this. I think indirectly, if I could answer your question by just referring you back to a very major problem that occurred last year in the Ballysadare River along the west coast. And that was shown to be an infection where the fish were infected by a fungus that we call Saprolegnia. But the underlying cause was actually water quality. So it emphasises the fact that these things can be very complex. What you see as an obvious effect may not actually be the cause. But what it very clearly shows is that our rivers are under extraordinary pressure at the moment. And I think for quite a number of years now, we've known that, both in terms of water quality, but also in terms of the effects of climate change. So we're seeing warmer water. When we have a drought, we have low water conditions, even if we don't reach a drought condition. that also can put additional pressure on the river. And as a result of this, we're seeing a very major increase in terms of the amount of plants that we're seeing both in the rivers and in the lochs. So in reality, the actual river channels and the lake channels, the lake beds, are under pressure. And certainly we have to be redoubling our efforts to try and make sure that we alleviate some of that pressure from those systems, because everything indicates that these particular problems, at least at peak times of drought or peak times of flood or peak times of high temperatures, they're going to continue into the future. And we have to think how we're going to manage this particular issue and how we're going to then deal with potential issues such as we've seen now on the Blackwater.
And I know hearing Conor Arnold there, I mean, it's soul destroying as he describes it. And local eyewitnesses said that the some of the fish were in terrible condition. They turned white. Some of them had eyes that had exploded in their head. I mean, this is very visceral, very upsetting to think about the extent of the devastation there. I suppose looking over the longer term, Ken, is it the case that we can still remain hopeful that this part of the river can be cleaned up, that these fish, these salmon, these trout, this freshwater pearl mussel there as well, that they can come back and we can make things better? Or are we looking at a sanitised river now?
Again, we have to await the conclusions of the study. But I certainly would be hopeful, because rivers have this incredible ability to be able to restore themselves. Having said that, this is not something that's going to happen overnight. You're looking at a situation where this is going to take literally years to restore. And in reality, we may be at a point where not alone the fish are affected, but the actual overall life in the river itself, in terms of the invertebrates and the food organisms that the fish feed on, they may also be affected. So how the river recovers and the speed at which it recovers, that really is unknown at this stage. But it's a very, very clear lesson to us that in the context of the really endless discussions that we've had about water quality recently, just the sort of issues that may very well arise and may hit us very quickly if we don't take this seriously. And I think there's quite a number of things that we can actually do. We don't have to sit back and worry about this. I think we can really seriously begin to tackle the whole question of restoring rivers. In the past, and people have heard me talk about this, I know, on other radio shows, we were certainly, some of the drainage schemes that we put in place were far, far, far too extensive. And we have a situation where a lot of our major channels now are not natural. The sinuosity has been lost. The channels themselves have been given an artificial gradient. The water runs off very quickly. So certainly river restoration is a major issue. Mm. Also, we need to be serious about reducing the amount of nutrients and indeed the amount of silt, because I've noticed over recent years an increasing problem with silt, possibly connected with our very large flood events. So reducing nutrients, reducing silt. And finally, we really need to think about shade, because with the increasing water temperatures and we have bare banks that are left behind as a result of drainage or other developments on a riverbank, we really need to be thinking about restoring the shade, the natural shade that's there that will help us to actually manage and reduce those water temperatures.
Cool, clean water is what the fish need. Well, Ken, thank you so much for joining us this morning. Obviously, the incentive long-term is restoration. The immediate concern is to find out what caused this and then to try and get that river back on track. But thank you very much, Ken Whelan, this morning. Well, it's harvest time on the Miller family farm in Fuddlestown in Wexford. And amid the bustle, Hannah Miller is juggling more than just farm work. A trained French horn player, she is in the thick of preparations for Fuddlefest, which is an on-farm musical festival taking place on the last weekend of August. And on top of that, she's also rehearsing for a major performance at the National Concert Hall in on August the 26th, where she'll join the RTE Concert Orchestra for Anne Dudley's Horn Concerto in a lunchtime concert. Well, when Dermot McIntyre visited her farm, he found her practicing with a very attentive audience of goats and poultry looking on.
Do you definitely recognize it when you hear the horn, because it's always the hero in every film. A lot of times in different symphonies, there'll be like this fanfare or call in some way that would hark back to the history of the instrument. Historically, the horn would have been a shepherding instrument. The design of it comes from alpine horns, which you'd blow into the mouthpiece here and it would all be curled out in a straight line, I think 3 meters long, and they would have used those on mountains to call from one mountain to the other. The different calls would represent whether there was like an attack by a wolf or whether there was a storm rolling in or just a check-in, like all is good.
So the horn could be heard a lot further than the human voice.
Yeah, completely. Yeah, because it's just all about projection. Like during lockdown, I was actually doing quite a lot of playing outside because just, I'd say my family were sick of me playing inside. And I heard from neighbours who live more than a kilometre away that they could hear me playing. There's a really beautiful horn call in Brahms's first symphony, which Brahms had heard in the Alps, played in the distance. It's like just a really gorgeous melody, so it's like one that would always come to mind when I'm with the goats.
That is beautiful, and it was amazing the moment you started playing. They ran towards you, didn't they?
That's Puck and Nelly just kind of having a bit of a tussle there. They're gathered around now waiting for the next instruction. They do seem to enjoy it. I got the goats for our own farm in 2020 because we had a really overgrown forest and we wanted it cleared a little bit. There was ivy growing up all of the trees and we just got 2 goats to manage the property a little bit. I just completely fell in love with them, so we've grown the herd to 4 now. I have been bringing them around to different locations. They were in Johnstown Castle for about 2 months recently, clearing a walled garden, and I just brought them down to my aunt's house now, so they're going to clear the ditches and stuff of her field.
It's beautifully kept behind us. We've got a duck pond, the lawn is all mowed, but in front of us, the hedgerow, like so many hedgerows at this time of year, thistles, nettles.
Yeah, getting really overgrown.
Yeah.
For sure. The goats are here just to tackle that a little bit, to make it a bit more manageable.
I can actually see the rear end of a goat. It's right in the thicket.
Yeah, those stumps there were completely covered in ivy and they just cleared them in 10 minutes. They're really hard workers. Goats are more interested in like things that are high up and hard to reach. They'll always get up on their back legs trying to reach up at the highest leaves. There's less likely to be parasites and stuff up high. They're huge at the moment. There's so much kind of protein in everything that they're eating that they are really looking healthy. I'd supplement their feeding with grain just for management of them so that they stay friendly and onside and that they know I'm their friend.
The ears of barley full, beautifully golden, nearly ready for harvesting.
Nearly, yeah. The combine will be coming in any day now. If it stays dry.
We've got the goats grazing behind us and we're stepping through now the barley field that's between your aunt's house and the farmhouse where you grew up.
Yeah, as a child it was a shell of a building and my parents kind of slowly did it up around them as they went, so it's really flourishing now because Mam has gotten so into gardening that the garden reaches out to the edge of every field. Like Dad has to stop her from gardening the fields almost. That
there's trees, there's lovely plants, then there's lampshades hanging in a big long string from tree to tree, like you would see in your great grandmother's sitting room with their little tassels.
Yeah.
And just below them a gigantic willow sculpture.
She's called the Willow Warrior Woman. And she's adorned by all the lampshades that were put up in the first place just for lighting, because we have a stage down here. My mum was going to all the charity shops buying old lampshades. There's lampshades going all the way down the laneway now.
So when people think festival, they're thinking a gigantic stage and speakers on both sides and massive screens. But you're running a festival right here in your farmhouse.
Yeah, Fuddlefest. It's a real small festival right in the middle of an operational farm. Like our family are all just like living in that house right there. performers that tend to kind of stick around for the whole weekend, and there's only ever one event happening at any time. So the whole audience goes travelling through the garden and then creates this atmosphere where everyone's giving their attention to everything.
It's where your musical community plus your local community here get to overlap for a little while.
Yeah, and I think that makes it really special as well. To immerse people in the festival is really kind of part of the ethos of it. Like this year we have the full orchestra of Wexford Symphonia doing the opening concert in the barn. Folk artists like Zoe Conway and John McIntyre doing a set, Cass Ensemble, we're doing like an experimental conceptual piece. Then we also do the total other end of the spectrum. We have like electronic dance music at night time. One of the nicest things about the festival is afterwards hearing from all the different people who were there. Everyone has a different opinion on what the best thing was.
Not every Irish festival has a silage pit as a venue.
No, that's why we changed the name of it to the Concert Pit, like for the sake of the festival and the poor audience, so that it seems a bit fancier.
But the acoustics, I'd say, are amazing.
Yeah, yeah, it has a really high vaulted tin roof and concrete walls. It's a real long, kind of narrow building, so it actually like emulates a church, and it sounds absolutely brilliant, like you can hear a pin drop. The farm is so closely linked to the festival, and the farming has to come first as well. Like if it's raining in the lead up to the festival, then it might not be suitable for cutting crops. So it can be really stressful if like the corn isn't ready to cut yet, which I hear from Dad every festival, like 3 days before, that it's not ready to go and that we won't have a campsite.
It is a pressure. Was there a moment that made you go, this is why I do what I do?
Yeah, in one of the first years of the Sunday morning, we had this absolutely brilliant singer-songwriter called Ali Comerford at like the wake-up concert. She was here on the stage and the campsite was just beyond the trees there, and everyone could like hear the really gentle soothing music from their tents and kind of were like drawn in from afar, stumbling out of their tents and coming to listen to the most like gentle, beautiful music. It was like the perfect start to the day, the real moment of calm for me, like when the goats are like happily grazing and you're sitting there with them and all is well.
Hannah Miller in conversation with Dermot McIntyre of Grey Heron Media. And for more on that, go to fuddlefest.ie. We have a text from Alan in Carlow. All roads lead to Tullow Show tomorrow, and great to have the earliest harvest since 1984 here in Tullow ahead of the show. Wherever you are this week, enjoy the weekend, and we'll talk next week.
Countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Listen back on the RTE Radio Player.